Hello, this is Nathan Lewis, and today we're talking with Greg Orrell, which is pretty interesting because he is the manager of the OCM Gold Fund, been a gold stock investor, stock picker for quite a while, I understand. Actually won an award in 2022 this year and last year from Lipper as the best gold mutual fund out there. The ticker is OCMAX, the OCM Gold Fund. Great to have you today, Greg.
Nathan, great to join you.
Super. Well, my understanding is that your family has been involved in gold and gold mining for quite a while. So how did you come to start managing a gold stock fund?
Yep. Going back quite a ways now. So the history goes back to the 1970s when my father was a stockbroker in San Francisco. And he was one of the few stockbrokers, especially on the West Coast, but also in the U.S., that knew anything about gold mining shares. And so with a lawyer, a friend of his, they started a mining company trying to reactivate mines in the Motherlode Belt of California. This was during the 70s, late 70s, that they started this mining company. They raised money, did a drilling program for mine project up in the Motherlode Belt called the Royal Mountain King Mine that ultimately went into production in the 80s as a joint venture with Burlington Resources, the railroad company. And so he learned a lot from that episode. I learned a lot of things to do and not to do just by seeing it firsthand. I got into the business also as a stockbroker in 1983. And lo and behold, I got into the mutual fund business in the late 90s when one of my clients had a small mutual fund and they asked if I would run it. So that's how I got into the mutual fund business. And so I've been specializing in gold mining shares since 83 when I got out of school. My background was economics and business administration, but through the years, when you've been in something for 40 years, you get an understanding of what is a mine, what shouldn't be a mine, where the characters are located in this business, and there's plenty of them. And, it's been often repeated and probably ad nauseum of, Mark Twain's famous quote about a gold mine being a hole in the ground with a liar on top. And, there was a reason why that quote, became so famous because, you've had these cycles where, people get gold fever and, there's nothing like gold fever and that greed is running and, instantly wealthy they're going to be. And certainly that's how gold rushes started. And you get gold rushes in shares instead of, everybody coming with a pick and axe and their wagon and making their way to the Klondike or their mother load or some other gold rush. They come through gold shares.
Right. Either on the buying side or on the selling side, right?
Yeah.
The wise guys are selling paper in Toronto.
Early in my career, Nathan, I used to get these calls from the promoters in Vancouver, and Murray Pesum's office was known for having a lot of promotions, and they'd call, especially, probably seemed like easy pickings, early on in my career, and they'd call down and, they'd start talking in a low voice and they say, "Hey, hang on, Greg, let me close my door," like they were going to give you some great information.
So, you're not going to tell anyone else the same line, right?
Yeah, right.
Even though that's their job. Yeah, that's a good one. I think everybody knows that when gold goes up, it's good for gold mining companies. And when, dollar price of gold goes down, it tends to be bad for gold mining companies. I think we got that. But what separates, in your view, a good stock picker in this sector from the average or below average kind of people that we have?
Well, first off, I think experience of being around makes a big difference of having seen the pitfalls, because it might be great where you catch a run on a certain stock that is being promoted, and but finding a company that has lasting and true value is something that I think comes with experience in the space, understanding the geologic potential of a district, and also understanding if management can deliver. And, one of the things that, I always look for is whether or not management does what it says it's going to do. And that's in any business. If management drifts from what they say they're going to do, just as if I'm a portfolio manager and I drift from doing something different than what I say I'm going to do. If all of a sudden, instead of buying precious metals equities, I'm buying, you know, copper stocks or lithium. Yeah, and so that's called style drift. And in the case of mining companies, you have management that starts to, you know, say one thing and do something different. And, you know, either that's because the project can't deliver. And so, you know, there's a lack of confidence that seeps in either for their asset or certainly for as an investor, you know, that confidence, you know, is certainly eroded.
Let me ask you, you said you got started in 1983. How many years did it take before you felt like you had a real advantage in the sector? You built up enough experience that you're, you know, one of the smarter guys in the room, so to speak.
You know, I don't know if I think I'm still struggling with that at times. You know, I think every bear market makes you question whether or not how smart you are.
I'm supposed to be smart. Why is it happening to me?
Yeah. You know, it's always a learning process. You know, I think I know enough to avoid certain pitfalls, but you do fall into the traps every once in a while of, you know, thinking that you're onto something good and, you know, it doesn't pan out. You know, from a portfolio manager standpoint, understanding that risk of position sizing and whether or not you get caught into something if the market turns. You know, Julian Baring, old London portfolio manager for Mercury Asset Management, you know, years ago, the first thing, you know, after speaking with him, he said, you know, so Greg, you know, you don't want to get caught in lobster pots. Certainly you get in and you can't get out. And so I've always taken that to heart of, you know, understanding position sizing and, you know, making sure that if I really like something, I will take an outsized position. But, you know, other than that, you really have to make sure that you understand the risk reward relationships.
Right. But on the other hand, you can only have so many good ideas. So, you know, it seems to me that some guy who's got, you know, 50 stocks in there, how many good ideas are in those 50 stocks and why didn't we concentrate more on those is my reaction. I wonder if sometimes managers spread themselves too thin in hopes of diversifying away their mistakes.
That's a good question. You know, I think that you have to have conviction on certain ideas. And that's what comes down to position sizing. One of the things about, you know, running a gold fund, if you're all in exploration stocks, you know, and somebody says, well, geez, I got into owning this gold fund and how come the fund's not moving? Or why aren't my gold stocks moving? A junior exploration is not a gold mining company. It's a risk company that's looking for gold. And a lot of folks get that really misconstrued with why they own, you know, a gold mining company, or, you know, thinking that they own a gold mining company when in fact they don't own a gold mining company. They own an exploration company that doesn't, most likely doesn't even have any reserves. They have some ideas and hopes, but necessarily, you know, where there's value yet. You know, there's optionality that they might find something, but there's not any value in terms of reserves in the ground and operating leverage to gold.
Is there a part of the market that you like to work in, or maybe you change from time to time, from, you know, the big caps, medium-sized producers to the small producers to the, you know, pre-production level people to the, you know, the moose pasture explorers? do you like to work in you know, smaller companies that are issuing secondaries and warrants and that sort of thing, or what has been your experience there?
My experience is, and I always go back and, you know, look at the various cards in my desk and I look at old portfolios of the fund and, you know, I think of, wow, that company's not around anymore. That company's not around anymore. And so
hopefully they got bought out.
Yeah. So yeah, it's either been bought out or been merged into something else, or it's been consolidated. And you know, one of the things that happens on exploration companies is, you know, they always need capital. And so you have capital cycles that, you know, if the capital's not coming in, then they start trading what they call come financing. And then you have a valuation that's basically down to nothing. And you know, then the company needs to be rolled back in terms of the number of shares outstanding. So you'll have a 1-for-10 and then they'll rename it International ABC Mining Company or Consolidated International And yeah, this is what the history of exploration companies are. So you have to be understanding that there's sponsorship for these exploration companies, that they're going to keep tapping the capital markets when they need it, and that there's going to be somebody there to finance them. Now, when I'm constructing the portfolio, you know, historically, and if I look at the breakdown, I'm usually about 25% in the large cap names, and then another 25% in intermediate names, and then another 25% in junior producers. And then I'll have a little bit in royalty companies. I have about 5 to 10% in primary silver producers. And what'll change is the percentage allocation to exploration and development. If I believe it, we're in a more aggressive stage, I will increase that exploration and development number, and do have to spread that over, a number of names. So you end up spending a lot of time on a small percentage of your portfolio, which is okay because, the risk reward can be quite dynamic.
Right. It's a lot easier to predict what Newmont's going to do over the next 6 months than some of these teeny companies where stuff's going on all the time.
The reason why you have the large cap names, gets back to when you own a gold fund, you want to participate in the upside of, you want to have that operating leverage to gold. That's what the larger cap names do provide along with the liquidity. Granted, you don't get, the outsized gains that you may get in a junior producer. And, so that's why, I do have a big chunk of the portfolio in junior producers. And so, if you combine junior producers and the exploration development companies, it's, it's about a third of the portfolio. Historically, where we have outperformed is finding companies where, significant capital has been spent in the past, and there's, good geologic potential to increase the throughput of an existing milling facility where that capital has been spent, and then the market will re-rate it.
If there's sort of a junior cycle where these non-cash flow producing companies are appreciated for their potential, then maybe forgotten because they're not generating any cash, where maybe do we fit in that today?
That is a really good question because, when you have Newmont hitting new highs and, what we're seeing right this minute is kind of a risk aversion on spec names and, smaller cap names. And whether that has to do with kind of a general risk aversion that's going on in the marketplace, which I think it probably is, NASDAQ being down and other small cap names being down across the board, playing into it, which leads me to believe that we're in an intervening period where the large cap names in the gold space are going up and hitting new highs like Newmont. And it says that, that capital is going to start moving down the curve. So as you start to get further moving sector and the gold price, you will see capital start to move down and, start to speculate more on exploration and development names.
So it sounds like we were hoping at least that we're sort of in the upswing of the cycle fairly early in the curve of interest in these names, let's say, valuation.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is not the bottom. The bottom was, December 2015.
Right.
After you kind of washed a lot of folks out that got in on the last cycle when gold ran up into 2011, and you saw the first move up into the $1,900 to $2,000 gold price, and then you backed off and went down all the way down to $1,030 as they held the threat of interest rate increases over the marketplace. And that allowed for the traders really to continue to act like a wet blanket over the gold market and sell it down. And gold could really only bounce once the first rate increase took place in December of 2015. And the same thing's happening again, where the rate increases have started and you're starting to see the gold price move. And some people say, well, the gold price, if you looked at the various times that the gold price has moved, it's moved when interest rates have gone up, interest rates have gone down, what actually drives the gold market. And so, a lot of people say, oh, well, it's the dollar. Well, it's not the dollar index. It's just an index versus other paper currency. So if you were to track, the dollar index going back to the 1970s when the Nixon closed the gold window, Yeah, the gold price goes straight up and the dollar index looks like it's gone straight across. The dollar is not what drives the gold price in terms of the dollar index. I mean, you know, the dollar being depreciated is probably more reflected in, you know, what has a higher correlation over that 50 years is the total federal debt outstanding. And that's a 93% correlation to the gold price. That tells you more about the debasement of the dollar over that time.
Okay. So what is your macro view at this time? Is this a good time to get involved or increase your weighting to precious metal related assets?
I think very few people are weighted towards gold assets. I think you know, the move has been to, you know, digital assets and, you know, wanting to have exposure there or some other assets classes. So I believe that there's, you know, very small allocation to gold assets right now. And I think we'll be at the early stages of, you know, large capital flows into the gold space. And yeah, it will be, and this sounds very promotional, it will be like, you know, Niagara Falls trying to get through the garden hose. It's really going to be difficult. You know, you'll have to expand the space out with through higher prices in order to accommodate everybody into the room. So I really do believe that it's early days. You go through generational moves in gold, where what I like to say is, you know, every generation has to relearn the monetary characteristics and appreciate them of gold. And so you'll go through periods where, you know, nobody, oh yeah, it's the, you know, barbaric relic at this and that. And, you know, there's, you know, something else is going to take its place. And, you know, and then it doesn't, you know, gold has stood the test of time for, you know, many reasons. And so, you know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, another generation is going to learn the appreciation of gold's monetary characteristics. So I do come at gold from a monetary standpoint, first and foremost. And, you know, and I believe that, you know, the mining stocks, you know, represent a gold asset, especially, you know, with the reserves in the ground being the major asset of a company. And so paper gold assets become discredited. You know, the reserves in the ground will become certainly have greater appreciation in the eyes of investors.
You know, the big institutional investors, the pension fund managers or endowment managers and kind of the big money institutional guys, I guess you'd call it career risk or something, but it's difficult for them to own precious metals, even when it makes sense, even when it, you know, even when it's going up, even when it's outperforming everything in sight, even when it makes sense from just, you know, portfolio allocation standpoint and, you know, not guessing the next 12 month move, but I'm looking at correlations and long-term returns and so forth. Tell me what, the, you know, how things stand now, if you talk with those guys, and are they going to change? Do you foresee a process where maybe they'll be allowed to own, you know, 5% of the $100 billion portfolio in bullion or something like that?
Yeah, sure. There certainly could be a time where, you know, you'll see that allocation. I mean, in 1980, 5% of all assets in mutual funds were in gold funds at that time. And now you can barely registers. And so it is cyclical, but, you know, you have to think of, you know, you can go back to, you know, 2013 when the gold price went down. There was certainly, one could question, you know, that market activity. And, you know, this is going to sound conspiratorial, but, you know, the war on gold is really that you want to keep folks in paper assets, in equities, and you don't want that capital diverted towards gold. And so, you know, as the banks have taken greater control over Wall Street, you'd have to question whether or not they have an interest in seeing capital flows and start recommending gold and gold assets to their clients. And so I would say that, you know, that is part of the hurdle that gold needs to get over before it sees, you know, significant capital flows. It has to be the independent outsized macro thinkers, probably the Ray Dalios of the world that represent large capital pools that, you know, start to drive the thinking of, you know, the investment banks, because, you know, in order to satisfy those clients, you know, they start to have greater resources towards gold and gold assets allocated. So I do believe that, you know, you will see institutions looking at gold in a more favorable light as credibility of the Fed, you know, comes into question more. I mean, you know, if I were to go back and look at, you know, just like Bernanke talking at $2.5 trillion on the Fed balance sheet when it moved from 800 billion to 2.5 trillion, at that time he said the balance sheet is only temporary, and you know, here you are at $9 trillion. You know, he was right. It was only temporary.
It wasn't 2.5 for very long, was it?
Yeah. And so when I got in the business and gold was trading around $300, $300 to $400, and I used to tell people, well, you wait until, you know, they start monetizing debt and people understand that. But, you know, you've had, you know, the Fed monetizing debt. And, you know, yes, the gold price is instead of $300 or $400, it's, you know, $2,000. And people used to say, well, you're not going to want to live in a world of $2,000 gold. And, you know, they've been able to manage the big run on paper through this time. And, you know, what we have to question, Nathan, whether or not, is there a run on paper and dollar hegemony? Is it coming right now? And, you know, all these moves by taking a sovereign country's foreign exchange reserves and, you know, locking them out in the case of Russia, I'm certain that other countries have taken notice of that. And, you know, it brings into question whether or not holding, you know, US dollars as a foreign exchange reserve asset, you know, really makes sense. And so, you know, what is gold? You know, historically, it's not someone else's liability. Whether you can get it into the market, you know, that's going to be a question, but you can certainly trade it with other entities, other sovereign governments, or an instrument that may be tied to it. So, yeah, I believe that the sentiment towards gold assets is going to change quite dramatically. And it's, you know, it's not going to be linear. It's going to be hard fought, as one would expect when you're dealing with trying to, you know, have, you know, the dollar be usurped as, you know, the global reserve currency, and Western governments wanting to maintain that. But if we were to look at the dollar, you know, going forward, and the current risk of higher inflation and all the structural issues that are in place for a real sustained inflation, you know, you have to question, you know, whether or not the dollar can, you know, maintain credibility in the face of that, because you can't raise interest rates without imploding the whole system.
That now seems to be the agenda. They're like going out in public and saying, oh, we're going to raise interest rates until there's more, you know, we get enough unemployment and the stock market goes down 30%. That's now kind of official, you know, policy, not quite official policy, but the Fed mouthpieces are out there talking about it.
Yeah, they did that in the 70s too, before they lost credibility. And so that's what I'm talking about. You know, the Fed losing credibility where, you know, everybody's not, you know, waiting on their next move to come out of their mouth or whatever statement they're going to come. Yeah, that absolutely has no meaning. And, you know, the gold market and the marketplace will cast aside any comments that they have, you know, once it's realized that, you know, things like transitory inflation, the Fed balance sheet is only temporary. You know, it's all BS at the end of the day.
It does seem like maybe it's only in recent years, but even in a bull market for gold, which arguably we've been in since 2015, end of 2015, arguably, you know, a typical stock market, bull market, it's going up 70% of the time. It's like, you know, kind of low volatility ramp. And then it has, you know, 30% correction or something like it. Not 30% down, but 30% of the time it's consolidating. And it seems that even in a gold bull market, it's turned around. It like rockets up 30% of the time, then says 70% of the time going sideways. I wonder if that's been your experience.
It does seem like, you know, people only rent the space.
Yeah.
My experience has been, especially, you know, over the last 30 plus years, is the feeling towards gold and owning gold assets by most advisors is, do I really have to? And, you know, that they, you know, they would rather be, you know, they would rather be in like, oh, it's growth and everything's going to be great. And when the NASDAQ's going up, you know, the gold shares are weak. And when the NASDAQ's going down, the gold shares are usually stronger, you know, because, you know, there is not that growth sentiment in the marketplace. And, You know, if I were to look at, you know, going back to 1968, and, you know, I plotted this on, you know, consumer confidence. And when consumer confidence peaked in 1968, you had, you know, for the next 10 to 11 years, you know, the S&P did absolutely nothing. It was actually, you know, flat to down. And, you know, the gold shares were up, you know, specifically, you know, they had a big move near the end, you know, 1979-80, when the gold price spiked to 800. But, you know, the gold shares during that period were up a few hundred percent, 500%. And then when it peaked again, you know, the consumer confidence index, you know, this is, I'm taking this off of Conference Board's consumer confidence index, and it peaked again in 1999, you know, for the next 10 to 11 years, you had another big move in gold shares, and the S&P did nothing during that 10 to 11 year period. And so, you know, we've had in 2018, you know, the Conference Board's consumer confidence index peaked again, or it's always right around the 139, 140 level. And so that would lead me to believe that, you know, that 10 to 11 year period, you know, even though the S&P did make new highs, you will look back and say, geez, you know, the S&P did absolutely nothing for the next 10 to 11 year period. And, you know, the gold shares were up, you know, a multiple, and, you know, outperformed during that time. And so that would take you to, okay, what are we looking at? We're looking at 2018 to 2019 as being the timeline for this cycle.
Yeah, the typical performance of the S&P 500. Yeah, you get those sideways decades, right? You can't go up forever. It would end up, you know, being worth gazillions.
Yeah, I would also say it's time to go sideways.
Big, yeah. You know, in a big sense.
Right. I'd also say that, yeah, and I'm not a big equity market bear here. I mean, granted, valuations have gone absolutely crazy and debt levels have been piled onto a lot of these companies, you know, by taking that, you know, low cost debt and, you know, whether it's, you know, paying it out in terms of shareholder, you know, and dividends or buybacks. But if you were to look at high inflationary periods in countries, you know, their stock markets actually went crazy to the upside, because people would rather own shares in companies than own currency.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So when you say it's not a bear, you sort of speaking in a more nominal sense. Let me ask you, in the gold stock sector, you know, sometimes valuations are low and sometimes they're high. And in the scale of your experience, where do you think they would lie today?
I think, and people do ask me this question quite a bit, as to, you know, where are we right this minute in terms of the industry? And I will say that, you know, close to 40 years, the industry is in better shape than I have ever seen it. Mm. And, you know, that is because of capital discipline. And some people say, well, you know, the majors aren't spending, you know, enough on exploration to replace production, and, you know, that they're increasing their dividends. Well, you know, I have been a big proponent of, you know, that mining companies should be paying significant dividends, because it's a depleting resource business. And so if you were to look at this business and really put it into, you know, how should a mining company allocate capital that is a producer? Well, there should be high enough returns. You can't have marginal returns in this business. I mean, projects that go into production with marginal returns, you know, that's one of the things that I've shied away from in the industry for a long time. You know, wasn't viewed as an option on the gold price. And so they put a lot of projects into production where the returns weren't really there, you know, in a declining gold price environment. So, you know, they were, you know, the margins got really skinny, and, you know, it created, you know, a difficult balance sheet situation. And, you know, then kind of led to some of them saying, well, we need to, you know, lock in our gold price by hedging. And so that became a big, you know, black eye on the industry. So, you know, the industry has done no favors to investors in terms of attracting them because of a lot of bad moves in the past. And, you know, certainly they were abused in the last cycle, you know, that ended in 2011. And, you know, they were issuing paper you know, faster than the central banks. And so, you know, they were depreciating, shareholders' interest, you know, on a per share basis in the reserves and production per share quickly. And so confidence was lost. And, you know, you could see that very clearly, you know, on the gold XAU ratio, which historically used to be between 3 and 5 and, you know, shot up to into the 20s. And I think it hit a high of 29. So that was a clear indication of investors, you know, fleeing the space because of the lack of confidence in management. Now, and I believe that, you know, probably Mark Bristow at Rand Gold, now he's headed at Barrick after the merger, has gone a long ways to instilling confidence. The industry needs to operate as a business like any other industry and put, you know, the in place what are considered, you know, return on capital initiatives that are show discipline. And yeah, you're seeing the business now, you know, it's distributing dividends to shareholders in a meaningful way. And if you look at this business, like I started off this point, and if you're in a depleting resource business, you should look at it that, you know, the shareholders need to participate in each mine. Otherwise, it becomes a fool's game of putting money from one hole in the ground into the next hole in the ground. And you're not going to get long-term investors if that's the case. So, you know, when companies are allocating capital, they have to look at it that, you know, you're going to, you know, put a new mine in production. A third of it's going to go to pay back the capital of that mine. And, you know, that includes all the exploration costs and capital to build it. And a third of it's going to go back to the shareholders in forms of dividends and buybacks. And another third is going to go back, you know, into, you know, sustaining the business and what the next mine is. And so if you look at it from that standpoint, you know, that's a sustainable model that will attract long-term investors to the space. And that's what we need.
I tend to agree with you. The management has had to learn a lesson about running a business along the way there. And I hope they did. I think they did. They're much more disciplined now. But I'm also curious just about, you know, the price to whatever your metric might be, you know, some kind of discounted cash flow like thing. Are you seeing a pretty good discount here, or, you know, things fairly reasonably priced, or what is your view on that? Are you finding, you know, stuff like, wow, that's a great bargain, it should be 3 times higher, or not so much?
No, I think you can look at it, and depending on what your view of the gold price is, if you believe, you know, even at the current gold prices, you know, the industry screens very favorably versus the S&P on almost every metric. Mm. Now, you know, what I would say is on historically on the mining companies, they are cheap, you know, whether it's, you know, on, you know, multiples of cash flow, free cash flow, and, you know, historic NAVs. I would say across the board, you know, the industry is cheap on a historical basis. And so, you know, what we have to see is, you know, what kind of capital flows are you going to need in order to, you know, get up to, you know, the peak valuations. And that's kind of what we're waiting for. So that all really comes down to capital flows and everybody getting excited about, you know, higher gold prices and needing to own the space. And that will happen. It's just, you know, where we are right now, it's saying that, you know, we've got a long ways to go to get there.
Okay, well, I'm going to wrap it up. We're running out of time. It's been real fun to talk to with the Real Gold Stock Pro, let me tell you. Let's just wrap it up. Is there one stock you want to highlight as being particularly interesting right now?
No, I tend not to, you know, come out with that one recommendation. Then everyone goes, geez, that guy was off on that, or, you know.
Oh, fair enough.
So I tend not to, you know, self-promote something that I have in my portfolio either, which
that's true,
seems a bit disingenuous. But, you know, probably, you know, Nathan, I have one question for you right here is, you know, what's your current thoughts on where we are from a monetary perspective on gold?
Yeah, I have a fair amount of experience with that. First of all, I have a lot of gold. It just is sort of an allocation, right? It's not really like a trade, because I just did a presentation about this for the Money Show a couple of days ago. Whatever happens in the next 6 months, it's hard to predict. But if in an environment where stocks and bonds are way overpriced, central banks tend to be very aggressive, They're not printing much money right now, but you could easily see them firing up again. Even just as an alternative, if you don't own stocks and bonds, you got to own something. And I don't want to have all my money in the dollar, right? USD cash. So in a sense, I can afford not to be bullish because I'm already in position. I tend to be a little hesitant compared to most people in the gold stock space. I think that central banks for now have a mandate to, not as like Volcker did, but have a mandate to, keep inflation from getting out of hand. But I think just immediately, kind of in the development of the last couple of weeks, they're basically saying, their big inflation solution is a big recession. And we all, our experience of recession over the last 15 years has been central banks turn around and have a very, extraordinarily aggressive response. And also governments spend money like water, right? We recently had a 15% of GDP deficit in peacetime. That's never happened in U.S. history for not a whole lot of good reason, to be honest, right? They're just handing out checks, basically, is what they're doing. And if they only do half of what they did last time around in a recession, I think it'd be too much. I think they're going to, people are going to look at that and say, these guys are losing credibility, let's put it mildly.
Right. Well, I would say that, look, the Volcker playbook, and that's not in play this time around.
No,
there is no way the Volcker playbook is going to come. If you had 20% inflation, the Volcker playbook of shocking the system to 20% interest rates is not possible. And you would have to say that, even trying to get it to, 5% interest rates is probably not an option, just because, the structure, market structure today with so many derivatives, has the potential to totally implode. And granted, yes, yeah, you would probably bring down inflation through implosion. But what we've seen is, like you said, they come in, the response is ultimately, bazooka monetary policy.
Yeah. And I actually think central banks will probably be a little more hesitant to do that, because I think they sense that, that's the end of the line for that stuff. But nevertheless, I think they'll be under various pressures. And I think, parliaments and governments, once, they've been spending so much money, it's like crack to politicians, it's not rational. You ask a crack addict, why do you take crack? They're not going to come up with a lot of good reasons, right? It's just what they do. And I think you're going to see something like that happen next time around. Anyway,
I just don't believe they get religion. So yeah, my take is that, as Bernanke says, he was never worried about deflation because of the, they had the printing press, and, with the social pressures for, minimum wages and, minimum
UBI coming up.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're looking at having, modern monetary policy thoughts, and you can just print, and if you lend it to yourself through monetization, that's fine. And I just don't see that, we are in a position that, where the dollar gains credibility and the Federal Reserve gains credibility through any process. And it's really coming back to the their past actions. And we used to say, this isn't going to end well, when they started the aggressive monetary policies. And I still believe, we're in the early stages of, it's not going to end well, mm-hmm, but the consequences.
Great. Well, it's been good talking to you. Nathan. Yeah,
yep.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we'll get together again sometime.
Yeah, sounds great. Appreciate it.
Thanks a bunch.